When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
We are back. Crossover NBA podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck, and we are just days away from the return. Ben Simmons headed back to Philadelphia as a member of the Brooklyn Nets. Simmons will not play in this game, Beck, but he is expected to be on the bench, where I'm sure the Philadelphia fans will treat him cordially and have nothing but respectful things to say to Ben Simmons. Sitting courtside. I thought it was interesting. Someone in the Philadelphia press corps asked Doc Rivers about a possible video tribute for Ben Simmons. Listen to what Rivers had to say.
Yeah, I do, actually. You know, Ben was Ben did a lot of good things here, you know. It didn't end well, right? Just like marriages and all kinds of other things don't end well, right? But Ben did a lot of good things here. And so, you know, it's funny. I don't know if we are or not, but if we did, I'd have no issues with it.
Beck, let's start there. Does Ben Simmons deserve a video tribute from Philadelphia?
Yeah. Actually, he does. Listen, it was an ugly exit.
Oh, you're being serious. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We'll continue. All right. I'll jump in after this.
I'm not trolling you here. I did shock you into silence for a second. Now, listen, I mean, video tributes, first of all, let's acknowledge right out the gate, and props to my buddy Yaron Weitzman for the story he did about a month ago about how video tributes in the NBA have just gone off the rails and everybody gets them. We throw them out like candy, like participation trophies, and they're silly and ridiculous most of the time anyway. That all said, the bar is obviously pretty freaking low for these things. Guys who have spent 5 minutes with the franchise get one. Ben Simmons spent a significant number of years, including as the number one overall pick of this franchise, with the Sixers, was an All-NBA player. He was an All-Star multiple times. He and Joel Embiid together, of course, led them deep into playoff series multiple times. He is a significant player in this franchise's history, and did great things while there. That is the definition of a player that you normally extend a tribute to. Now, that said, is there a big fat asterisk because he forced his way out, because he had a horrific ending with that postseason performance last spring, and because he not only forced the trade, but sat out for months waiting for that trade? Yeah, all that stuff matters too. But was the balance of his career with the Sixers, or was his career there on balance, worthy of a video tribute? By today's NBA standards, easily. We have seen far lesser players who did far less for franchises get video tributes, and I don't see why you don't do it. But plus, by the way, before you shoot me down and mock the living hell out of me for the next 5 minutes, I would just say this: it's the classy thing to do. I know it's going to trigger the fans. The fans are going to be triggered anyway. It's the classy thing to do, and in today's NBA, that's why all these video tributes exist in the first place, is to show we're player-friendly, we appreciate our players, we appreciate players even who left on bad terms, and we want the message sent to all the other players who may one day want to play here that this is how we do things.
If there's a video tribute for Ben Simmons, I think the crowd might actually riot after that. I think they might storm the floor in that moment. Ben Simmons does not deserve a video tribute from the 76ers. Howard, he played 4 seasons in Philadelphia. They never advanced past the second round. In his 5th season, he quit. He said, I know we're a contender. We might be able to even win a championship this year. I don't want any part of you, Philadelphia. I don't want to be a member of the 76ers. I understand what you're saying. Like, if you're basing it on what the NBA bar is, where guys that, you know, have multiple 10-day contracts are eligible for video tributes down the line, yes, Ben Simmons, you know, you could make the argument he has earned that type of reception. But given the circumstances, there's no way he should get a video tribute, nor will he get a video tribute. The man quit. Like, he quit on this team. Simple as that. I'm not minimizing the things he went through. I'm not minimizing the mental health part of it. But he decided a long time ago he was done with Philadelphia. And when you quit like that, you can't go back and expect any type of positive reception.
I don't remember for sure, Chris. Did James Harden get his video tribute in Houston? Because he quit. Now, granted, he did more there. He was there longer and took them farther. This is what I'm saying. It's a sliding scale. Let's just acknowledge that. It's a sliding scale, and it takes into account maybe longevity with the team, maybe level of success by yourself and the team's success, and maybe the how ugly the exit was. It's probably all baked in there somewhere. But Ben Simmons spent a good amount of time there. By the way, they had the best record of the NBA last season. 49-23 in a shortened season. That would have translated to, I don't know, whatever, 55 wins in a normal season. He was a part of good teams, a 52-win team, a 51-win team. No, they never made it out of the second round of the playoffs, but they did make multiple trips to the second round of the playoffs as a team built around two youngish stars. Like, let me put it this way. Let me give you a big, crazy, hypothetical if to set this off. If Ben Simmons had gotten the trade that he wanted last summer, still not leaving as a free agent, still forcing his way out, still asking for a trade, demanding a trade, however you want to frame it, and got that trade so that we don't have all the ugliness of him just sitting out games and all the haziness of motivations and all this stuff, and it doesn't tank their season at the outset, and the other season's fine, obviously, because of Embiid, would he have gotten a video tribute then? Do you think it's okay if he had simply been traded in July and came back in November as a member of the Nets? Does he get a video tribute then, or is it just the ugliness of that 54-game pseudo-strike?
Yeah, but Howard, that fits the phrasing of, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? Like, that actually happened. Like, what happened with Ben Simmons over the last 50-plus games and all the nastiness that's gone on? That happened, and that's right. Part of the narrative.
But my point is, what he had done for the franchise up until ugliness.
Given what the bar is, which is so low you can't even see it for video tributes nowadays, yes, then maybe Ben Simmons would have gotten a video tribute from the team. But this year happened. You can't just erase that. So
I'm not erasing it. I'm just saying.
When he comes back, there'll be no video tribute. There will be no warm reception. I give Ben some credit for going and sitting on the bench. Like, I don't know what that's going to be like for him.
I love where we are as the media in the year 2022. The breathless reporting around, he's going to be on the bench. He's going to sit on the bench. Today, Steve Nash confirms, yes, Ben Simmons will, in fact, be on the bench. Ooh, yeah. I mean, my gosh. Like, the trivia that we get mired in right now with the things going on in the world. But anyway.
You're going to get cheese whiz thrown at him from the third row of the stands. It's just, Philadelphia's got to be just ready for that. I give him credit for going. And
my last thought on that real quick is this, because we know that Philadelphia does have a reputation. Philly, please do not live down to your reputation.
Correct.
Sometimes Philly gets defensive about this and says, you're holding us to a higher standard, or you don't call us out for the things that other fans get called out for because we have this rep. All of that may be true. So prove it to us. Do not let this thing get ugly Thursday night. Don't be like, and I'm going to say it, the way Cleveland treated LeBron his first trip back.
Oh, that was
having
bad.
Left as a free agent to go to Miami, that was the single ugliest scene I've experienced firsthand in my career. I'm not saying it's the ugliest scene that's ever happened to people. I'm saying that I personally have been witness to in person. That was the ugliest I've ever seen. I hope that Philly doesn't go that route on Thursday.
Yeah, I agree with you there. All right, something else I want to talk about off the court. This week, Russell Westbrook, after another tough game, addressed reporters about some of the negativity that's been circling around him. I'm going to paraphrase here because Russ
spoke for a while on this, but he was responding to a question about some of the tweets his wife Nina had put out about some of the nasty things that have been said to him. And one of the things Westbrook said was that, like, he's proud of his name, and hearing things like Westbrick, he's let that go in the past. He's not going to let that go anymore. It goes without saying, and you kind of touched on this with, you know, the Philadelphia Simmons stuff, Cleveland, like, there's a line, right? Like, there's a line that should never, ever be crossed. And if you're making, you know, whether it's on social media or otherwise, personal attacks, death threats, whatever it may be, no place anywhere for that. The other stuff, though, Howard, like, you know, Westbrook is, it's catchy for, like, opposing fans to throw out there. Like, that's not really a personal attack on Russell Westbrook. I put that on the same level as, remember what Sacramento did to Westbrook, you know, earlier in the season when they played cold as ice every time he missed a shot? Like, it's just kind of, it kind of goes with it. So, like, I feel like there is room in the game for, like, healthy heckling, like, healthy, there are lines you can't cross, but if you have something clever to say at a guy, and if you're trying to rattle them, that's kind of part of the home court advantage. It's kind of part of it's baked into what, you know, teams get from playing games on their home floor. I don't know how you feel about that. Like, I can certainly sympathize with Russell Westbrook and the year he's gone through. You know, the spotlight's been on him. He's been blamed almost entirely for the Lakers' struggles, when the reality is there are layers, as you know, to the Lakers struggling. There's Anthony Davis not being healthy and struggling. There's the defense being a disaster. He's been a big part of why they're bad, but he's been sort of isolated as the biggest reason and the reason as to why they're struggling. But I don't know, man. When I hear stuff like, you know, don't use Westbrook, or don't use phrasing that isn't doesn't cross that line, I don't really have a huge problem with that. Those types of quote attacks.
Yeah, I mean, let's, you know, we got to divide these things up. It's not all the same category, right? I don't know what his wife was alluding to in terms of were these death threats on Twitter, social media. Unfortunately, social media is a toxic stew sometimes, and there's a lot of stuff that gets said, mostly from anonymous accounts, troll accounts, everything else. He said that his family's not comfortable at games right now. I interpreted that, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, I interpreted that to mean that maybe his family was getting harassed even at games, or things were being said that would be inappropriate. Like, do not target people's families, for one. Do not issue death threats. That seems pretty simple. Calling somebody Westbrook, it's like Magic Johnson, I think it was in a headline in the LA Times or something back in the day, got called Tragic Johnson, and I can't remember the context, and it was brought up again with his awful, ill-fated talk show that he hosted for a while, and I think people
I forgot, the Magic Hour.
They slapped him with Tragic Johnson again then. It's like, you know, there are plays off of names, like, it's not the most sophisticated thing, it's kind of playground stuff, it's adolescent, it's immature, whatever. But that stuff's within bounds. And in basketball, a brick is a bad shot, a shot that clanks badly. That is a lot of Westbrook's shots these days. And yeah, it kind of fits. That's a basketball criticism. And it's not particularly mean-spirited. It's insulting. But yeah, that happens in sports. You boos and taunts go along with cheers and ovations. And you take the good with the bad, as long as people are staying within bounds. He's conflating a lot of that stuff. I get it. He's stinging right now, and that's understandable. But yeah, I'm sorry. As long as you're playing for that team, as badly as this has gone and as badly as he's played, there's going to be a lot of criticism behind it. That's not going to end until his Lakers career finally ends, which I assume will be in about another 6 weeks.
Yeah. I mean, well, who knows at this point, like, how they deal with that contract in the off season. He also, as you well know, Howard, like, when you put something like that into the universe as something that bothers you, you know, if you go into a hostile environment, you are going to hear that over and over and over again. That's just catnip for fans. But I mean, I do think there's a line. As long as you stay in front of that line, it's okay to kind of go after opposing players. Not personally, I mean, certainly not in some of the ways that's being described, but I mean,
it comes with being a fan. I actually enjoy some good heckling. Like, if you and I sit press row in a lot of different places, if I hear something funny, I'll kind of turn and laugh at it. Like, I mean, sometimes fans can be creative, and they can, yes. Like, if you do your research, I have some friends, I'll bring in like a personal level. Like, I have some friends that when we go to Fenway Park, and sit in the green monster seats at Fenway Park, sometimes they will like literally do research on who the left fielder is for the opposing team. So like you'll shout out like, you know, whatever, it's making it up. But you batted 202, you know, during that second season. You can't hit a lick. Like, just stuff like that. If you're creative, I think it's fine. If you're just being, you know, a dick, then it's not. So
I gotta say, I think I'm afraid to go to a Red Sox game with you and your Boston friends.
You'd have a great
time.
I think
that would be I don't know.
Great time. Just don't be the left fielder. Don't be the left fielder.
I'm definitely not keeping up with you guys on your beer intake. I'm sure.
I forget who it was. It was years ago. One left fielder actually turned around, looked up, was like, that was a good one. Like, even he appreciated like kind of the specificity of some of the heckles that were being thrown down on. All right. I want to talk about a couple other things here. James Harden continues to go swimmingly for James Harden and the Philadelphia 76ers. 5-0 in the games that Harden has played, and the schedule hasn't been too tough yet, but I'm watching Harden look a lot like the player we first saw when he got to Brooklyn last year, being a playmaker, embracing getting the ball to Joel Embiid, embracing making sure that Tyrese Maxey, who has been excellent in the games that Harden has played in, making sure he maintains a prominent role in the offense. I watched the 76er team, Howard, and yeah, they're giving some points. Like, defensively, they're still trying to find their way, but I'm looking at them like the firepower this team has, if they stay healthy, there's as good a chance as anybody to win the Eastern Conference, and maybe even the whole thing, because I think there's a decent chance whoever wins, pretty good chance actually, whoever wins the East winds up winning the NBA championship. So anything new that you've seen from Harden and the Sixers since we last talked last week?
Nothing that leaps out other than him sitting out the one game that we thought would have been a really intriguing test of
Miami.
Yeah. And so they get spanked in that game. And like, look, as you noted, like the early wins with Harden there, beating Minnesota, beating the Knicks twice, beating, you know, Cleveland was, you know, Cleveland's a quality team.
Cleveland's struggling, though. They've been struggling.
But they're struggling. And Chicago, a quality team, but not at the level of the Milwaukees and Miamis and Phoenixes and that. So like, I'm still kind of waiting. Like, Brooklyn will not be a true test because, they're obviously down one Ben Simmons. Although, you know, going against Durant and Kyrie is something. But the Nets have been a mess. Then they play Orlando. Then they're home against Denver. So that's interesting because we get Embiid versus Jokic. And we've got that whole MVP debate going on. At Cleveland versus Dallas versus Toronto versus Miami, finally get on the 21st. So like, there aren't that many tests left on the regular season schedule at the highest level that the teams that you have to worry about beating in the postseason. So that said, they've been phenomenal, right? Like there's nothing to complain about in terms of the Embiid Harden partnership so far. And the fact that Maxey, as we talked about last week, is thriving after all the concerns about, well, what's going to happen when he gets, you know, has to take a second seat to Harden as a ball handler and playmaker. They are absolutely in position or have shown the ability to win it all.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I want to see them play better defense over the next, you know, few weeks, because when you get to the playoffs, you've got to be able to get stops. And you knew when you made that trade and you gave up some of the pieces you gave up that you might take a half a step or a step back defensively. And I'm watching, you know, Harden is giving effort on the defensive end, but he's still not a high-level guy. I guess the question is, do they have enough firepower offensively to overcome those deficiencies? And yeah, to your point on the schedule, I think I want to see them play against those top-tier teams before I make any judgments. But I go back to what I said last week. Like, I'm not surprised at all to see James Harden thrive in this role. The question is going to be next year, when he's armed with the equivalent of a 5-year contract at $250 million, you know, how satisfied is he on some of those nights where he's not getting the kind of shots he's used to getting? And does he get frustrated with Joel Embiid? Does, you know, sharing a backcourt with Tyrese Maxey grate on him for whatever reason? So this is the honeymoon year for Harden and the 76ers. We'll see how far they can go. All right, one topic we've been putting off for a while, Howard, has been the MVP debate. And we are, I believe, more than 2/3 of the way through the season at this point. There have been some shuffling, you know, amongst the MVP, you know, top tier guys in the last couple of months. But for me, as we come down kind of the home stretch of the NBA season, you're really deciding what center you like. To me, it's down to Jokic and it's down to Joel Embiid. Like those two guys who have both been putting up monster numbers, who have both been leading their teams to, let's just say, better than expected records. The Sixers, you know, climbing up towards the top of the Eastern Conference, the Nuggets overcoming the season-long loss of Jamal Murray, the nearly season-long absence of Michael Porter Jr. Both these guys have been through the roof. I'll get into the weeds a little bit, Howard, on who I like, but I mean, do you see anyone besides those two as being able to kind of crack the party and get some of those first place votes?
Yes. I think this is a three-man race, not a two-man race. Giannis Antetokounmpo has to be in there. His stats and Embiid's stats are nearly identical. You know, it depends on which category you're looking at, but they're very, very close in all the key stats, whether it's the counting stats per game averages, their efficiency. They're very, very close. And their teams have a nearly identical record right now, too. And as you know from our previous discussions, as far as I'm concerned, team success has to matter, too.
Let me ask you this. Let me ask you a question on that, because I looked at that, too. Like, and Giannis, his numbers are out of their minds. Like, when I look at the 76ers this year, I look at a team that has overachieved up until this point, that you take away an all-NBA talent in Ben Simmons, and I think the Sixers, even though they do have close to identical records as the Bucks, have overachieved at this point in the year. Milwaukee, I don't want to say they've underachieved, but they've just kind of achieved. they've been good, but not great. And they've had some lulls during the season where they've lost a few games in a row. They've had like 3 out of 5 type of stretch. Not all Giannis's fault. It's certainly not, maybe not any of his fault. They've had injuries. Brook Lopez, his absence has been huge for them. A couple of the guys, you know, you saw DiVincenzo, and so, you know, they've had some Pat Connaughton, some guys going in and out of the lineup. But I leaned towards Embiid in that particular discussion in part because of how the Sixers have played season long versus how the Bucks have played.
I get that. You know, I'm one who says context matters all the time, so I'm not about to throw out context in this case. But at the end of all of that is, the Sixers and Bucks have nearly identical records, and Embiid and Giannis have nearly identical statistics, or at least close enough for them to be in the same conversation. You know, the Bucks did take a bit of a step back. That happens with championship teams having their, you know, maybe a hangover, whatever it may be. Losing Brook Lopez for what's been pretty much the entire season has been a huge part of that. Is Brook Lopez as important to the Bucks as Ben Simmons was to the Sixers? No. Is Giannis overcoming Lopez's absence as big as Embiid overcoming Simmons's absence? No. Yeah, they had other injuries, obviously. Holiday was out for a while. Middleton was out for a while. They've had some roster reshuffling. But at the end of it all, the Bucks are in, like, this is what I look at, right? It's that whole thing of, you know, personal excellence, team success. And on the team success level, are the Bucks a clear contender? Yes. Is Giannis putting up dominant stats? Yes. Therefore, ergo, he's still in the conversation. If the Bucks were terribly underachieving, if they were like mired in, you know, 6th, 7th place, and they were on pace for like 45 wins, then I would downgrade. Even if Giannis's numbers were great, I would say, you know what, the Bucks aren't what they were, and you lose a little of your MVP luster if your team's not great. But that's not the case. Like, the Bucks are still on pace to win, you know, well over 50 games. And they're on the same pace as the Sixers. So I think it's a three-man race.
Yeah. Well, all right. So two-man race for me, three-man race for you. The player I'm leaning hardest towards right now, though, is Nikola Jokic. And it's not recency bias. I have this opinion, you know, for a couple of weeks now. But the last couple of games, Howard, where he went for 46 against New Orleans. What was it? 35, I want to say. Against Golden State, 32 against Golden State, adds 15 rebounds, 13 assists, back-to-back triple doubles. I mean, these are, and look, if you're on social media, you know, everybody kind of debates the value of advanced statistics. Jokic blows the field away when it comes to advanced statistics. His efficiency numbers, they're all absolutely ludicrous. Now, the Nuggets, as we record this, are sitting in 6th place in the Western Conference. A couple of games back of third, so they can make a run. And if they start getting healthy over the final few weeks, maybe they can with some of the guys I mentioned coming back. But even if they don't, if they still sit in sixth place, he's the guy I think deserves MVP. I mean, these numbers are just insane. And as we said at the top of the show, he's kind of doing it. He is doing it without top-tier guys around him. Now, Embiid lost Ben Simmons. Let's factor that in, no question. But Jokic is without Jamal Murray, without Michael Porter Jr. These are all-star caliber players that he is playing without right now. And to have the Nuggets playing at this level, and he's doing it in some way single-handedly, you know, to me, that makes him the clear frontrunner.
Yeah, I mean, this is where we start getting into this whole debate about supporting cast and how much of this, whether you want to call it narrative, whether you want to call it context, whether you want to call it grading on a curve. You know, we don't need to relitigate Westbrook. We end up going down that tangent frequently, you and I. But, you know, that was a case where people looked at his supporting cast and said, his supporting cast is trash. And he's averaging a triple-double for the season. Therefore, Westbrook is the MVP despite being on a team that won 47 games and was sixth in the West. Jokic is in a similar position right now, although his stats are, I think, even more impressive than what Westbrook did that year. I mean, Jokic is nearly averaging a triple-double. And I don't make a big distinction, by the way, between averaging a triple-double versus averaging what Jokic is, which is 26, nearly 14 rebounds, and 8.1 assists. Like, he's 1.9 assists shy of a triple-double. Like, 26-13 or 26-14 and 8 is still really impressive, and I don't think there's a substantive difference between 8 versus 10 at that point. He leads the league in effective field goal percentage. He leads in PER, if you want to go advanced stats. He leads the league in win shares, if you want to go with that. He's got the most minutes by a ton, if you want to weigh that into account, too. Because when we talk about valuable, he's played a lot more minutes than Giannis and Embiid. My general rule of thumb is that you got to be on a clear contender. And Westbrook was the one lone outlier in about a 35-year span. And this is not just, top two or three in the conference. It's also, the standard was, by precedent, 50 wins or more. That's what defines a clear contender, and that's what defined all the MVPs prior to Westbrook and since Westbrook. The Nuggets, to Jokic's credit, are hovering right in there. They're on pace for about 49 wins right now. And I'm not going to say I'm going to hold hard and fast that he's got to get to 50, but if he gets to 50 or 50 plus, if the Nuggets get there, it's going to help his case a lot in my mind, because I still look at it as, like, am I going to look at the Nuggets at the end of the day and say I think they're a contender to win the West or the win the whole thing? Probably not. But this, you know, this is not just an individual award. It is not most outstanding season or most outstanding player. It's MVP. We've always baked in whether your team is one of the best, and that's part of your MVP case. Where people fall on that and how much you want to weigh it is eye of the beholder stuff, and I'm not going to argue with people if they want to say that we can't hold it against him that he has injured teammates. I do say, by precedent, though, we usually choose our MVP from among the best teams. Are the Nuggets one of the best teams? Not at the moment. But that's where this gets difficult. It's not most outstanding player. It's not gaudiest stats. It's not best advanced stats. It's most valuable. And it's still an eye of the beholder thing. Right now, I would have Jokic probably a notch below Giannis and Embiid because of that primarily.
But does your opinion then swing? Like, let's say in the next few weeks, the Nuggets get one or more guys back into the mix and they wind up as the number three seed in the Western Conference. Like, is that high enough? Because they are, I don't have it in front of me, but I think only a couple of games back of the third seed in the conference. Like, if they get to that point, does that entirely change your calculus?
Right, and I want to make a quick aside here about the records, because people have said, like, oh, well, their record isn't any different than, like, the Sixers or whatever, so standings are irrelevant. Well, standings are still somewhat relevant because it does speak sometimes to the strength of the conference and the competition you're going against, and so you have to factor that in. But I'm looking at it more of not where you are in the standings. It's more about that 50-win mark. That's the sign of a top-tier team, is at least 50 wins. If you're below that mark, most NBA seasons, you're looking at a team that's probably a first round out, maybe gets to the second round. It's not a contender. 50-plus, and obviously the higher you go, the more legit you are as a contender. And the MVP, aside from the Westbrook year, for about 35 years, has always come from a clear contender. So it's not where they get in the standings, Chris. To me, it is about the win total and whether they finish on a note where it looks like, you know what? I actually think the Suns and Warriors and Grizzlies have something to worry about with the Nuggets. And let's see, maybe they get there and maybe Murray comes back. Maybe Michael Porter Jr. comes back. Nothing detracts from how outstanding Jokic's season or historic his season has been. And by the way, I voted for him last season. So this is not some anti-Jokic thing either. I voted for him last season. But this goes to my point. Why did Jokic win it last year? Because the Nuggets were elite. Why is LeBron not in the discussion this time? LeBron's putting up MVP caliber statistics. He's not in the discussion because the Lakers are a disaster, so he doesn't deserve to be. So you cannot extract the team success from the individual when you're talking about MVP. It's always been part of it. Why is DeRozan a candidate now with the Bulls? Well, doing mostly the same kinds of things he's always done. He wasn't a candidate in Toronto. He wasn't a candidate in San Antonio. But his addition to the Bulls elevated the Bulls to a level where we said, you know what? This team is for real now. And DeRozan is the guy who put them over the top. So yes, team success has always been part of this. And you cannot separate these things.
Yeah, you make some good points all the way around. I do think you mentioned Westbrook a couple of times. There are almost shades of that with Jokic this year because of how much the Nuggets have lost. You see the astronomical numbers he's putting up. You look at the players the Nuggets have been without. I do think if Jokic winds up and the Nuggets wind up in the top three in the Western Conference standings, there will be a surge of support that goes
his agree.
Way.
I agree.
Yeah, so it's going to be close, though. Apparently, if you've got, you know, you're leaning more Giannis than Embiid that side of it, and I'm more Jokic this side of it, it'll be interesting to see what the final results are. Last thing for you, Howard. Greg Popovich, now one win away from being the all-time winningest coach in NBA history, tied with Don Nelson as we record this. They play on Wednesday, San Antonio does. When Pop passes this, like, what is the discussion around him? Do we consider Greg Popovich as the greatest coach in NBA history? He will have a collection of rings. He will have a whole bunch of wins. He will have the added element of being the guy that shopped for the groceries. I mean, yes, he had R.C. Buford as his right-hand man for many, many years in San Antonio. They had a deep bench in terms of executives. Sam Presti came out of there. Dennis Lindsay came out of there. A lot of talent in that front office to provide Pop with the right players. But, I mean, he's going to have a lot of raw numbers on his side, Howard, to make the case that he is the greatest coach in league history. What say you to that question?
The first thing is, there was a column. It was both amusing and, I think, right by our buddy Mike Finger at the San Antonio Express News, where he pointed out that Pop, as far as he's concerned, got the record 3 years ago, because that's when his combined regular season and postseason total became the biggest all-time.
Which should matter, right? Like, you know, you are only a coach. I mean, your greatness is validated in the postseason. Like, that's when you need to win the game.
Listen, if Pop had achieved this same win total that is going to give him the all-time lead over 26 seasons, but had never won a championship, we're not talking about him the same way. We'd be talking about him the way we talk about Don Nelson, who he's about to pass, who he's tied with at the moment. So, to me, Pop getting that record changes nothing. We already thought he was one of the all-time greats. And we thought he was one of the all-time greats because he won five championships over a 15-year span in which he had to make a lot of adjustments in personnel and style along the way. If we're going to do this thing, you know me, I hate trying to like pick, like, who is it? Is it Pop? Is it, you know, Auerbach? Is it Phil Jackson? Is it Pat Riley? I hate the discussion because, like, the contexts are so different and the cases are so different. But if we're going to start putting their numbers up against each other, like, Pop gets the all-time win total in part because of longevity. This is his 26th season. Pat Riley had 24. Phil Jackson had 20. Longevity matters, but if you start looking at the rest of the top 15, top 20 in all-time wins among coaches, you'll find a lot of guys who are higher in the standings than guys who should be ahead of them when we talk about who's the better coach, right? Like, George Karl's way up there. He got a lot of jobs over a long period of time. Is George Karl better than Red Auerbach? No. and there's a lot of those you could point to. So here's what I look at. Phil Jackson 20 seasons, 11 championships. That's really, that's a success rate that's pretty hard to top. Three separate three-peats within them. And it was actually four different teams, if you think about it. Like, the Bulls were two different teams. It was Scottie and Michael with a completely different supporting cast the second time through. Shaq and Kobe win three. They trade Shaq. They completely reconstitute. And now it's Kobe and Powell and Bynum and Odom and all those guys. So Phil Jackson had three three-peats. He had championships with kind of four different squads, in a sense. He's 11-2 in the finals. His regular season, since we're doing regular season wins for this record that Pop we're talking about, his regular season winning percentage, Phil Jackson, was 70.704. Pop is at 0.658. And granted, Pop went through all these rebuilding years as well. He's coached longer. Five championships, 5-1 in the finals, never repeated. Whatever that's worth. Pat Riley, and this is the only three I really looked at this way. Pat Riley, 24 seasons, five championships, four with the Lakers, one with Miami. Went back-to-back in 87 and 88 with the Lakers. 5-4 overall in his nine finals, and nine finals is a pretty nice mark on its own. That's 4-3 with the Lakers, 0-1 with the Knicks, 1-0 with the Heat. Regular season winning percentage of 636. And then there's the fact that Pat Riley has been the top basketball exec for the Heat for a very long time, and presided over five more finals and two more titles. But that's his overall resume, not his coaching resume.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, there's a lot that you can factor into these things, especially like all-time greatest coach, greatest modern day coach, greatest coach in the free agency era. I don't know. They all deserve to be discussed, I guess, is the thing. And what Pop has done is absolutely remarkable. And I think Pop will be the first one, when he gets it, to say, he'll downplay it to the hilt. And he'll say at some point, if he hasn't already, I was just fortunate enough to have Tim Duncan. Because the entire Spurs organization has been saying that since the day Duncan arrived.
Yeah, he will absolutely do that. So when I look at this list and I try to pick a name off of it, I kind of look at the strengths of all these coaches. Like, Phil Jackson, in addition to being a great strategist who, you know, with Tex Winter, built that triangle offense, which was so successful in so many different teams. Phil Jackson, to me, is the greatest coach of superstars we've ever seen. And that's a compliment. Like, it's not easy coaching superstars. Like, Doug Collins tried with Chicago with Michael Jordan. It didn't work. Other coaches at different times tried with the Lakers. It didn't work. Phil Jackson, with big personalities, Michael Jordan, Shaq, Kobe, was like successful at the highest level. His ability to communicate and maintain a steady presence with a team is remarkable. Pat Riley, I look at, and I'm like, how many coaches completely change their philosophies like mid-stride? Like, Pat Riley with the Showtime Lakers, like up-tempo, behind Magic Johnson. He gets to New York, and it's like, let's get into a street fight every single night. Like, that was the attitude of Pat Riley. Like,
shout out to Chris Herring's book.
I know, shout out to Chris Herring. That's not easy to do for a coach. The argument for Pop is a few of those things, right? Like, Pop can coach stars. He had some of the most humble stars you could possibly find in Duncan, Manu Ginobili, Tony Parker, who were very low-key type of guys. Kawhi Leonard, of course, for many years. So he could do that. He could also shift philosophies. I mean, you kind of alluded to this, sort of in mid-stride in San Antonio, they went from being a team that won based on defense to one that, you know, played behind Tony Parker and were more offensively oriented towards the end of Tim Duncan's run. The reason I and again, is it recency bias? I don't know. But the reason I want to say Pop is because he did it all in San Antonio. Like, he did it in San Antonio. I understand Duncan wanted to play there, kept re-signing. But it's not easy to build that type of dynasty in a market like San Antonio. Phil Jackson did it in Chicago and L.A. Pat Riley did it in New York and Miami. Red Auerbach did it in Boston during a different time. So, like, that he was able to do this in a market like San Antonio, which never, ever, ever attracts free agents, and really didn't during the Pop era. They were so successful in the draft, they didn't really need that marquee guy to sign as a free agent. To do that in San Antonio, that makes me lean towards Greg Popovich. There are plenty of arguments otherwise. I am here for them all. Send them my way, tweet them, whatever you want to do. But To build that type of dynasty, that two-decade-long dynasty in San Antonio, to me, that makes his accomplishments most remarkable, and that's why I lean towards him as the greatest of all time.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, too, right? Because there are coaches who won a lot of games and were great coaches and great innovators. Like, I'm thinking of, like, a Rick Adelman who really had a great imprint on the NBA, but Adelman never got a chance, you know, never won championships, and so we don't put him at that level, and he wasn't a big personality, you know. And so, like, you know, Larry Brown.
Shout out Rick Adelman. You saw that stat that was circulating on social media. Like,
about the Kings.
Yeah, eight winning seasons with Rick Adelman, like 29 without in history. Like, I'd hire Rick Adelman right now. Bring him back. Yeah, like, what are we doing?
But like, you know, like Larry Brown, big personality in a lot of ways. Won a ton of games. He's eighth all time on the win list. Won a championship in the finals a couple times. You know, but you look at the championship count. If we're going to do the rings discussion, it's Phil Jackson with 11, Auerbach with 9, and then Pop and Pat Riley with 5 apiece, and nobody else really in the discussion. Then a bunch of guys who might have won a couple. Excuse me, there's John Kundla way back in the day also won 5. Steve Kerr's got his 3 and maybe still more to go. But it's not, you know, it's a pretty short list when you start taking into account finals and championships in addition to the win totals. Because if you look at the list, the all-time list, it's a lot of guys who were just lifers, right? Like Lenny Wilkins racked up a lot of wins over a lot of seasons. He's 3rd right now. Jerry Sloan, George Karl. This is not to downplay them, by the way. You get your longevity by earning it for the most part in this
Don
league.
Don Nelson, one of the great innovators of
absolutely
of his time.
Right. But doesn't have the championships or even the finals appearances coach to go with it. And so it's a different assessment, and we can mock rings culture, and we should a lot of times, but in this discussion, especially for coaches, that's the gig, right? No one's going to get extra credit for being the greatest development coach of all time if it didn't ever result in finals appearances and titles.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. Certainly a discussion that will be had for weeks and months after Pop breaks this record. Who long knows when Pop retires? Maybe it's this year, maybe it's next year, but could add to that win total even more in the years to come. Howard, good stuff, man. We'll do it again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.